Hello and welcome to Worlds Apart. Being a generous friend and a fair enemy is a maxim advocated by many ethical and religious traditions, which until recently also had its place in geopolitics. The whole corpus of international law was written and upheld on the premise of a minimal civility that states would show to one another as a safeguard against an all-out war. What could possibly bring that spirit back to global affairs? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Adriel Cassonta, a London-based political analyst and risk consultant. Adriel, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure.
Given the fact that you're joining us from London, which is a very rare treat for me these days, I want to start from afar and mention the lecture that I attended just this past weekend about the Arthurian legends, which are very, very popular in Russia, as well as this whole spirit of dignity and honor that King Arthur and his knights espoused. And it wasn't just about the values, it was also about their dedication and loyalty to one another. And that got me thinking, you know, we hear these days a lot about the Western unity and how it's been solidified in opposing Russia. But when we look at bare facts and the policies that Western countries are conducting towards one another, are they being fair or generous to each other or even to their own people?
Thank you for asking me this question. I think that, first of all, I would start with saying that, you know, this honor and dignity should be placed in a part of the fairy tales, because we are fed with the information that, you know, that the honor, being truthful to your fellow human being or to your fellow countryman, is something that should be, you know, upheld when you grow up as an adult person. But what we can see and what we can see before our own eyes is that, you know, each country is for themselves. The European Union can't have a coherent foreign policy because each country has its own national interests. So if you have a sum of different countries with different geographical positions, different historical heritages, it's really difficult to form certain coherent geopolitical or geoeconomic policy. What we are seeing now is that the bloc is divided or split. And also, when you're asking me a question whether European countries are coherent or whether they don't agree when it comes to the policy vis-a-vis Ukraine, we can see that the populations within each and every country in Europe is against this very narrative and this very foreign policy push against Russia, because it is backfiring. I mean, the high energy prices, which are just contributing to the high inflation here in the UK, people who are, you know, using the food banks. I mean, the situation on the ground is horrible. But we've heard time and time again from the so-called leaders that this is the price to pay for our values.
You mentioned the issue of narrative and what is being sold to the people. And I think it also parallels the typical plot of the Arthurian legends in the sense that there would be a fair maiden that was abused in some sense, that would come to this round table and ask for support. And this is essentially the narrative that we are hearing from the West, this innocent, pure Ukraine that was for some reason attacked by this horrible monster from the North without no prior, you know, justification. Does this narrative correspond to the geopolitical realities of the last couple of decades as you perceive them or, you know, as has been documented in global history?
Not really. I mean, anyone who is familiar with the situation from the very beginning, I mean, it started with, I mean, in 2006, Robert Kagan was quite explicit that the color revolutions and moving NATO eastward to Ukraine will serve to expand the Western liberal hegemony. So if one is wants to stay truthful to the facts rather than narrative, it doesn't correspond. But the plot that you've mentioned corresponds with the people's imagination, because we all prefer when the good, you know, beats evil, right? So it is triggering a certain patterns in our thinking in order to, you know, to manage a consent within the populations throughout the world, or predominantly in the West, to support, even though that it is backfiring and is hurting the societies in the West and other parts of the region, as especially in the global South. No, it doesn't correspond, but it is skillfully used to make the societies compliant and willing to suffer. But as we've seen in France, in other parts of the world, in Italy, in Germany, people are resisting. They are, you know, now not willing to sacrifice their life, their well-being, their economies, their, you know, livelihood, or even when it comes to a conflict between NATO and Russia, which is, God forbid, I hope, far away, their lives.
Now, I know that you followed this conflict, the tensions between Russia and NATO, for quite some time. And back in 2014, you wrote that for the sake of Ukraine, the EU and the United States have to come to terms with Russia having its legitimate national interests, just like any other country. Russia has its legitimate security interests that it's intent on protecting. And it sounds self-evident, but yet, if we look at the last 7 years and the very persistent and I think very deliberate Western effort to sabotage any peacemaking in Ukraine, it's pretty clear that the West simply doesn't accept that premise. What do you think is the current goal of Western policy on the Russian or on the Ukrainian track? What they would ideally like to achieve?
They are not specifying. They are just saying that Ukraine has to win. So we don't know what exactly this win would look like. We know that for several times, Henry Kissinger said that perhaps Ukraine should be, or President Zelensky should be, more realistic about the settlement between Moscow and Kiev. If we see what is being done, that, you know, constantly new weapons are being sent with the longer range, I'm not sure whether it will, set up in diplomatic terms. Because if someone wants to achieve a diplomatic solution to the conflict, which is already evolving into a direct conflict between NATO and Russia, because we have to bear in mind that at the moment, the republics in eastern Ukraine are participating in referenda, which what President Putin explicitly said, and it was also repeated by Sergei Lavrov, a foreign minister of Russia, Russian Federation, is that once those republics will join Russia, the country will use any means to protect them.
I think that's a very important point. And there are several factors that go into that decision-making as far as the Kremlin is concerned. But one of them is definitely a tactical military strategy, because regardless of whether the West accepts those referendums, the character of the war will change for Russia in terms of its tactics, in terms of the weaponry that it can use, and in terms of the means that it will employ to achieve its goals. Now, do you think that will change the conduct as far as the conduct in this conflict as far as the West is concerned?
Well, I would like to think that it will change, but I'm not sure, because as I previously said, we have to look at what they are doing and what they are saying. And this month, there was a certain proposal called a Kiev defense document that was presented by the former prime ministers and foreign ministers from the NATO countries, where they were proposing basically to make Kiev a de facto NATO member. So I think that this referenda should have taken place 8 years ago, in my opinion. I think that President Vladimir Putin dropped the ball when it comes to this referendum, when the people were suffering. I mean, Russian population of Eastern Europe, Ukraine were suffering back then, where they were harassed and killed. But apparently the human rights, you know, don't apply to Russian citizens or Russian population in Eastern Ukraine, but it's a separate topic. But you rightly said that this is a tactical maneuver, because first and foremost, although everyone is trying to portray President Vladimir Putin as a madman, I'm not sure whether he is a madman, because he's a person who finished law. He's a lawyer. He has a PhD in economics, so he's quite well versed with all everything that's happening.
History has seen many tensions between Russia and the West before, but during the Cold War, there were some mechanisms of sort of managing those tensions, arms controls, you know, efforts to de-escalate, some back-channel diplomacy, but we are not seeing anything at the moment. Both sides are sort of going full speed towards achieving their objectives. There are no negotiations, any efforts to come to the negotiating table between the Russians and the Ukrainians are being torpedoed by the West. Are there any safeguards left, as far as you are concerned, against an all-out war, against a third world war?
Well, there are no safeguards. We know that the United States withdraw from any agreement as far as, you know, the proliferation of weapons and nuclear treaties are concerned. So it opened a gate to a nuclear exchange. I would say that Western media and Western politicians are misinterpreting what the Russian government is saying. It's not blackmailing, but it's just saying, as perhaps mother would say to his child, don't, you know, touch a hot pot because you will get burned. So it's not a threat, it's just a stating a fact. So, you know, there's a saying in geopolitics that nuclear power never is never defeated. Because the last resort of being pushed to the wall is using these nuclear weapons. Otherwise, we wouldn't have these nuclear weapons. And I can assure you that the United States, if the country would have been pushed to the wall, would do the same. Because this is the rationale of having a nuclear weapons.
Atrael, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
So what we've got to do is identify the threats that we have.
It's crazy.
Confrontation, let it be an arms race.
Who is on offense? Very dramatic development.
I personally am going to resist.
I don't see how that strategy will be successful.
Very critical time.
Time to sit down and talk.
Worlds Apart with Adriel Casonta, a London-based political analyst and risk consultant. Adriel, before the break, we were talking about the world hovering on the brink of another global conflict and the lack of any safeguards to prevent it. And you know what got me really concerned the other day? I heard one well-respected and very even-tempered Russian analyst who used to be very well-received in the West suggest that the only thing that can bring Western decision makers back to reality would be a credible threat to their own countries, not to Ukraine, not even to Europe, because the Americans couldn't care less about Europe, but a credible threat to the American mainland. And this is not a person who is known for, you know, any war-promoting statements. I wonder if you agree with that, and how concerning is that?
It's very concerning because we know that America, unfortunately, has already sacrificed Europe and its development. I mean, America has succeeded in industrializing Europe. I mean, what we are seeing at the moment is the corpuses of Europe. We will have during the winter blackouts. They are advising us to, you know, to taking cold showers. I mean, how ridiculous is that? So when it comes to your question about the credible threat, yes, I think that until United States will not find itself in a position that it can be realistically harmed by Russia, it will push other countries to antagonize Russia and move forward with that threat. Because as I said, this is not a video game. It is real. People are dying on the ground, as many American foreign policy makers and analysts are saying. America is willing to fight Russia until the last Ukrainian. So they are using Ukraine and the Ukrainian people to their geopolitical to achieve their geopolitical objectives, and they are using them as a cannon fodder.
That then raises a question of how that threat could be communicated to the United States, with Russia being a responsible member of the international community, because having nuclear weapons saddles the country with enormous responsibility, not only before the Americans or the Westerners, but before the rest of the world as well, but also defend its interests, because the room for maneuver here is not too broad.
I mean, to be honest, there's no room to maneuver, because how many times you can communicate that that a certain country crossed a red line? How many red lines have to be crossed in order for the other party to, you know, come to the conclusion that we have enough? I mean, we poke the bear and the bear is really angry and it can retaliate. So I would, you know, move a little bit back from the Arthurian fairy tales to the Greek tragedy. And there was a concept of the Deus ex machina, a god from the machine. So whenever there was a story where there was an unsolved problem, all of a sudden, Deus ex machina was appearing, and this problem was automatically solved. So in order to ask your question, I think that I don't know what would be a Deus ex machina in this particular case. But other than that, I don't see any other mean to communicate something which has been communicated time and time again to the Western partners of Russia.
Now, I share your interest in Greek literature, and I'm sure you would agree with me that the ancient Greeks saw hubris as the main sin, and putting themselves in the place of God was considered to be something that inevitably would bring ruin upon people or forces that do that. Now, I'm struggling as a Russian who studied in the United States. I have many friends there. I love the American and the British culture, but I'm failing to understand what could possibly drive this kind of policy, because it's one thing to dislike Russia, but you cannot pretend that it doesn't exist, and you cannot pretend that its nuclear weapons don't exist. Why do you think the West is so uncompromising in trying to not only punish Russia, but to hold on to its hegemony, which by all measures is not held up by the reality itself?
Well, I'm glad that you've mentioned the concept of hubris, but we know that after hubris comes nemesis. So it's a rational consequence of hubris. And once someone is in this hubristic mentality, it doesn't perceive world as it is. So if you are delusional, which is I can state by the fact that the blob or the policymakers in United States in Capitol Hill are deluded. They are hubristic. They are immersed in hubris. They don't care. I mean, for them is to achieve their hegemony. So once you are in this hubristic mode, I mean, how can you be? Govern the entire world? How outrageous is that? I mean, if you are the exceptional country, you don't perceive other countries as an equal. They either comply with your so-called rules-based order, which has nothing to do with the public international law. And trust me, I've studied law, and I'm a lawyer by profession. So there's no such a thing as a rules-based order. But once you are an exceptional country, first among, you know, many. You are creating rules as they go, and either countries comply or they are being punished. And Russia said, no, we have our own national legitimate interests. They've been trying, as we remember, before the special operation or the conflict break, Kremlin was sending letters to have the mutual security agreement with the United States and other countries. But they dismissed that. They dismissed by knowing that they are dealing with the nuclear power. So this entire conflict could have been easily prevented, but it wasn't, and it was done with intent.
Now, let's speak. You mentioned the rest of the world, and I think it's not just Russia, but many other countries that are not ready to accept the Western-led order anymore, simply because it's unfair. It only benefits the West, and it ruins the planet, and it doesn't even benefit the Western society, Western people. It only benefits a very narrow group of people who, for some reason, want to add more trillions to their trillions. How do you think the rest of the world is reacting to what's happening? Because it seems to be hedging its bets for the time being, but deep down, do you think countries would like to see more democratic governance when it comes to global affairs?
Of course. My mom is Jewish and my father is Tanzanian. So I'm quite familiar with the global South voices, and especially in Africa. And as you probably know, recently the American ambassador to the United Nations, a black lady, African-American lady, said explicitly during her visit to Africa that there will be significant consequences if the African countries will, you know, deal with Russia. And this met with outrage. I have several conversations with people from Ghana, from Kenya, from Zanzibar, from Tanzania, and people were outraged. How United States can, you know, push countries. And this goes back to, let me give you an example of a famous president of Ghana, Kwame Nkrumah. He wrote a famous book called The Neocolonialism, The Last Stage of Imperialism. And it was published roughly in 1965. So once this book was published, the United States Department was outrageous, and they canceled automatically their so-called aid to Ghana, which was worth $25 million. So we have to understand that, going back to your fair governance on the world stage, that the global South want to participate. And Russia and China are communicating that the global governance should be democratic, regardless whether the country is perceived, according to the Western standards, as a democracy. But the global governance should be democratic, which means one country, one voice. That's why we see that there's a strong support for the global southern countries for Russia, and it will be a strong support for Russia and China as well, because there are a lot of grievances, and people who in the global south, in Africa, in Latin America, what they are seeing being now conducted vis-a-vis Russia is the same treatment that they've been met with from the West for all these years of colonial era.
Can I bring the Arthurian legends one more time? Because I think there's one more metaphor that is very sort of relevant here, and that's the metaphor of the round table. If you remember, it was Merlin the magician who gave the king that round table, and what was inscribed on that table was, I think, by helping each other, we become equals. Initially, that was supposed to be the rationale of the United Nations, that all countries would sit around that round table and they will be able to settle their differences by mutual respect, by some minimal decency towards one another, understanding that they're doing that for the sake of the global peace. Do you think the UN has lived up to that noble goal? And what could be done to make that organization truly efficient?
Well, I think that there's a high probability that the United Nations will share the fate of League of Nations, which was dismantled. it doesn't represent the global voice. I mean, the voice of the international community. It is a very narrowly constructed voice of international community, which is United States and its colleagues and friends around the world. In Asia, we have Japan and others, predominantly in the Western Hemisphere. But unfortunately, United Nations doesn't have tools to somehow impose its will on the United States, which is the most powerful country in the world. We can go back to the fact that unilaterally, United States invaded Iraq, even though that Kofi Annan was against it. So whenever we hear about the UN Charter, that the Russia should comply with UN Charter, that we should ask ourselves, how many times United States has broken the UN Charter. So this is double standard. I mean, you can't require from other countries to comply with UN Charter, although they require, but not applying the same rules and laws to yourself. And this is what the United States is doing.
We've been hearing about this multipolar world or more democratic governance for quite some time. It's one thing to aspire to something. It's quite another thing to actually practice it. Do you see any signs around the world that the countries are actually ready to engage with one another on an equal footing? That is, being a generous friend and a fair enemy to one another.
We have to pay close attention to what is happening in different, multilateral frameworks like BRICS, like Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which quite recently held its summit in Uzbekistan. We can see that many countries are, trying to move away from dollar and have exchanges in their national currency. So these are the signs that people are afraid. We have to understand that it's not so easy to say to the hegemon that, look, I want to participate on an equal footing with everyone around the globe. So people are, just hedging their bets because they don't know in what way the United States, the declining hegemon will react. And once the psychology of decline is that, once you realize that you don't have any other way to suppress and make other people compliant with your will, you are becoming very much aggressive, and countries are afraid. But what we are seeing around the world is that yes, there is a mutual consensus that the governance and the interactions between countries have to change, and hopefully the change will be brought by the relationship between China and Russia. Otherwise, I can see that we will just stuck in this unipolar world where America is just coercing other countries and making the lives of other people miserable.
Adriel, it's been great talking to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.